I have used a lot of commerce platforms in the past. By far, the most robust is Shopify. No matter how complex your business needs and no matter how large your business grows, Shopify can handle it. And they do handle it for brands like Rothy's, Ruggable, Allbirds, Knox, Magnolia, Brooklinen, Glossier, and Cotton, to name a few. You may already use another e-commerce platform and you may be super unhappy with it, but you've already put a lot of work into it and migrating to Shopify could seem impossible. But I'm here to tell you that it is quite easy. When I migrated to Shopify back in 2022, their apps and tools meant I just had to make a few clicks and everything was ported over as if by magic. Shopify also lets you design your storefront however you like, which from personal experience I know isn't the case for many other commerce platforms out there. All these features and all this control can result in more sales more often. So stop leaving sales on the table. Switch your business to Shopify today and discover why millions trust Shopify as their all-in-one commerce platform to build, grow, and run their businesses. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/practical, all lowercase. That's 1 month for just $1 at shopify.com/practical. shopify.com/practical. Hey there, Precaptans. Today, I am joined by Michael Tremblay. You might know Michael Tremblay. If you don't, you should. He writes for modernstoicism.com. He has an app on the iOS store. It's called Stoa Meditations. He has a podcast called Stoa Conversations. There are links to these things in the description of today's episode, and I would encourage you to check those things out. He did his PhD on Epictetus. I can't remember from what college, but it's probably more important that he did his PhD on Epictetus than we give any credit to the university he went to. I believe he is a proud Canadian, and he's also an accomplished martial artist. And this conversation was not planned. A lot of you in the Patreon suggested that I have Michael on. Michael and I have spoken before. I'd like to think we're friends, but we've never met in person, so maybe we're just more like professional acquaintances who kind of like each other a bit, and I have actually been on his podcast. So it was easy to invite him. I was happy to do it. I'm always happy to follow the direction and grant the wishes of those who support this podcast financially. It's very much appreciated. And on that topic, I have just one new patron to thank today. A shout out all to yourself, John T. Bonacorsi. I think I've said that right. Or John T. Bonacorsi. It's double C's. It seems Italian, and so I feel like it should be Bonacorsi. But if I'm saying it wrong, I've now said it wrong a bunch of times, John, so I'll stop. But thank you very much for becoming a patron of this podcast. If you are not yet a patron of this podcast, you can become one by going to stoicismpod.com/members. It costs just $5 a month. You get ad-free access. You get to make suggestions about the show and guests and those things. And you get access to private conversations. I plan on inviting Michael into our private Discord community so that we can have a conversation that involves all of you patrons, giving you direct access to Michael to ask questions that you'd like to hear him answer. Again, to become a patron of this program, go to stoicismpod.com/members. Now we are going to take a really brief sponsorship break, hear from a couple of sponsors, and then I will return and you'll hear my conversation with Michael Tremblay. Stay with me. This episode is made possible in part by Factor Meals, and I know that I've raved about this company and service in the past, but forgive me because I'm going to do it again because it is absolutely awesome. Chef-quality meals, each shaped around whatever nutrition methodology you prefer, paleo, vegetarian, vegan, low-carb, keto, whatever floats your boat, delivered to your door every week to help keep you eating the way you want to eat, even on and especially on days where maybe you don't have time to make the choices you want to make. And all of this is customizable to your schedule and lifestyle. At the very least, you need to learn more about it and decide whether or not to give it a try yourself. Head to factormeals.com/practical50, that's practical 50, and use the code practical50 to get 50% off of your first box plus 20% off of your next box. That's practical50 at factormeals.com/practical50 to get 50% off of your first box plus 20% off of your next box while your subscription is active. I have used a lot of commerce platforms in the past. By far, the most robust is Shopify. No matter how complex your business needs and no matter how large your business grows, Shopify can handle it. And they do handle it for brands like Rothy's, Ruggable, Allbirds, Knox, Magnolia, Brooklinen, Glossier, and Cotton, to name a few. You may already use another e-commerce platform, and you may be super unhappy with it, but you've already put a lot of work into it, and migrating to Shopify could seem impossible. But I'm here to tell you that it is quite easy. When I migrated to Shopify back in 2022, their apps and tools meant I just had to make a few clicks, and everything was ported over as if by magic. Shopify also lets you design your storefront however you like, which, from personal experience, I know isn't the case for many other commerce platforms out there. All these features and all this control can result in more sales more often, so stop leaving sales on the table. Switch your business to Shopify today and discover why millions trust Shopify as their all-in-one commerce platform to build, grow, and run their businesses. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/practical, all lowercase. That's 1 month for just $1 at shopify.com/practical. shopify.com/practical. Hey there, Prakaptan. Welcome back. Today, I'm joined with a fan favorite. A lot of people asked for this individual to come onto this podcast. Maybe he's surprised to hear that, but I don't think so. His name is Michael Tremblay. He's an MMA fighter. He's an all-around talented writer and the co-creator and co-founder of Stoa, Stoic Meditations, which is an app on the Google Play Store and on Apple Podcasts. And of course, you have a podcast that's in the same vein and with the same company called Stoa Conversations, which is excellent. And that I've been on. And I'm just now realizing it's taken me this long to invite you onto this podcast. I feel a little bit bad because I appeared on yours a while ago. But welcome to the show, man. Glad to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tanner. Good to chat with you again.
I think we're going to talk a little bit about what you've got going on, if you've got anything going on, but then let's talk about rage and regret. And I released an episode, what will be last week at this point, on that topic, regret specifically. And I know you spend a lot of time in MMA style fighting, maybe MMA exactly that kind of fighting. And I'm interested to explore what prompted you to take that on, if it's a treatment, a self-treatment for frustration, rage, anger of your own. But before that, what have you been up to, man?
Yeah, so I mean, as you mentioned, have the Stoa app, Stoic Meditation app. We've been putting a lot of work into that, a lot of new courses, a lot of new content on that. We've also got our podcast. So really just trying to, I think it's kind of in a similar vein to what I understand your project to be, Tanner, which is we want a type of stoicism that is accessible, but also accurate. And I think that's like a hard middle ground to land
it
on.
Is. Yeah, nobody seems happy when you try to do it.
Yeah, it's like it's either too watered down or it's you know, I don't want it to be obscure and non-helpful for people either. Just for the sake of you don't want it to be pedantic, I would say is the worst form of it. So that's what I'm trying to do, trying to work on that mission and really taking up I would say Epictetus's. I'm a big Epictetus guy. I did my PhD on Epictetus, as you know, and taking up his goal of teaching Stoicism in a way that's transformative and gives people a kind of a program to practice. So combining theory with practice, figuring out ways to give people exercises that actually help them feel happier, improve their character, entrench their understanding of Stoicism. And that's what we're trying to do with the app. So that's where my focus is right now.
Do you feel a little bit... I feel like this sometimes with this podcast because I'm trying to hit a very similar mark. Do you feel like a therapist sometimes? And are you cautious about that? Like, you're like, oh, I better be careful how much advice I'm giving and how I'm giving it, or I'm going to break a law or
something. I mean, that's something like even with therapy. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I think even therapists are cautious about being prescriptive and cautious about being, you should live this way, or this is the right way to do things. And then I think people are attracted to philosophy because it skips that step. It says, well, no, this is the way you should live. It gives a conception of the good life and to different degrees of particularity, but at least Stoicism says there's some wrong ways to live and there's some right ways to live. And if you do this, you're a bad person. And if you do this, you're a good person. So when I talk about it, I mean, I try to stay at the level of the Stoic said, right? And you're trying to frame it in that because I know I'm not an expert in contemporary psychology or contemporary therapy. But I do also think that there's important to have spaces for people that take take stands and take positions and say, well, you know, I think you should do this, or I think you should be this kind of way. And I don't want to shy away from those kinds of conversations, but I understand your concern as well. So, I mean, I haven't really felt the concern about I'm crossing a line, but I am aware that there is a kind of contemporary psychological expertise that you want to be careful about.
The thing that I find most difficult about it, if I'm being honest, is that maybe you feel this way too. I feel like I've found the answer. Do you ever feel that way about Stoicism? Like, it's so clearly, obviously the answer to so many things that you have to pump the brakes sometimes to realize that, of course, there are other answers to whatever the thing is. But I'll be out in public and I'll hear someone use the word good, or they'll be having a conversation about how to make something excellent. And I always feel like interjecting and saying, but do you have a definition of what good means? And then, like, drawing them into some kind of Socratic conversation that would be quite annoying to them and everyone around me and make me look like a pedantic ass, probably.
Well, I feel like I almost have the opposite issue, where I feel like maybe I'm not as hardcore into Stoicism as sometimes people expect me to be, where I feel like, you know, I'll be like, oh, Aristotle actually said some things that are pretty compelling too. And I've had people read threads on Facebook where people are like, oh, Michael's not a Stoic, or he doesn't believe this. And I think it's important to stay open-minded about there being different ways to live. And really, for me, the meta goal is that you're living an examined life. And I think you were hitting on that when you were like, well, do you have a definition for good? For me, that's the meta goal. I don't think there's any value to being unreflective. But then once you're reflective, I think Stoicism is one answer, but I try to keep the humility that it might not be the right one, or there might be something that I'm missing. You know, we're still living, we're still learning. We might not feel this way 20 years from now. So it is a answer, but I try to keep some. As long as people are engaging honestly in philosophy, for me, that's the standard to clear. And then if the answer is different, I have a lot of space for that.
Okay, so now I've got to ask, what brought you to MMA? Because you're not just someone who does this as a, you're not an enthusiast, although I would suppose you're also that. You must have a genuine love for the sport, but you're quite accomplished in the space, at least the way it seems online. You've won some awards and participated in some what I perceive to be large matches. Is that true? And how did you get drawn to that? Did it have anything to do with Stoicism or your search for, you know, the right way to live, so to speak?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I'm glad it's true. Otherwise, I would be in a rough spot. I'd be like, oh. So my specialization is in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I've been like a lifelong martial artist. My specialization is in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I did compete in MMA. I had 4 amateur fights and a pro fight. So there's different levels that you can be of fighting pro, and that puts me at certainly the lowest level, but I've definitely like checked that bucket list, you know, got into the cage. And that's kind of, you know, UFC rule fight, UFC style, that's an organization. But my specialization is in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is one of the martial arts that gets mixed into be MMA, right? And that's the chokes, the arm bars, the submissions and stuff like that. And so I've competed internationally. I mean, I was a very serious Jiu-Jitsu competitor for a long time. I have won a lot of kind of tournaments, I would say, at the provincial and national level in Canada, and then competed internationally and had some success internationally. In terms of what got me to that, I mean, I'm happy to just stay down this rabbit hole. But for me, I've always had this real interest in crossover between disciplines. So I was attracted to martial arts because martial arts was always taught in an ethical way. So you have kind of sport or athletics, and then you had martial arts. And for me, martial arts always involved character development. We were not athletes. We were martial artists. There was an ethical obligation, a kind of Spider-Man: with great power comes great responsibility. We're going to teach you how to kill people. But what comes with that is the responsibility to be able to control your anger, to control your character, and to, you know, be just, be kind, stand up for the weak, stand up against bullies, things like this. And there was this physical dimension, but also this moral, ethical dimension. And I would say martial arts was the first place, because I didn't come into philosophy until my 20s. Martial arts was the first place, and I should say also, I was not in from a religious family. Martial arts was the first place where I had explicit moral education, kind of explicit discussion of, no, this is what a good person looks like. This is the right way to act, or you're not living up to your responsibilities. You're not living up to your potential ethically and morally, not just in terms of your grades, not just in terms of your performance at a sport, but in terms of the kind of person you could be. And then, okay, so there's that moral education, but then what's the vehicle for obtaining that transformation? What's that vehicle for becoming the better person? And then martial arts combines those two. Well, it's by training. It's by encountering hardships. It's by doing difficult things. It's by being put in situations that make you uncomfortable. It's by being disciplined, working on your temperance and your self-control and things like this. So I wouldn't say I was a fully formed adult who came to MMA or jiu-jitsu as a way to work on, you know, anger problems or as a search for an outlet. I would say that I started that rather young, and it really shaped the way I saw, I would say, life. I think I ended up being attracted to ancient Greek philosophy because I saw, oh, this is the same kind of question. This is the question that the martial artists are asking, which is grounded in kind of an Eastern tradition, which is, what is the right way to live? And then how do we become the kind of people that can do that? And so I see an incredibly strong connection. And Epictetus sees this connection too, right? He makes a lot of references to wrestling. He makes a lot of references to athletes. And they're not one and the same. And he doesn't recommend that you become a wrestler to become a better Stoic. I think that's something that I would argue for, or at least that it's one way to do it. That's not what Epictetus says. But Epictetus says, look, we can learn a lot as philosophers from wrestlers. We can learn a lot from athletes. Really, because it's this craft, and it's this development of a skill in a way that's very analogous to developing our characters.
It's also, now that you say that out loud, and I hope nobody listening is going to think that I'm talking about them in particular, I'll say that I'm talking about myself, because I think this is probably true. And I bet that it includes a lot of people who are listening. When you are philosophically minded first, or when you're philosophy forward, it does tend to be the case that you are not the kind of person that gets out of the book, gets out of the classroom, and goes and gets physical. And I would say almost that there is a tacit fear or discomfort with being physical. I mean, I don't see a lot of people in the philosophical world. You are very much an outlier in this regard, right? I don't see a lot of philosophers going out and hitting the mat and arm barring people, or, as you said, learning how to kill them, but using that knowledge well and safely and all that, of course. And that's interesting to me because it makes me think of Epictetus's division between the half of the thing that you're learning is in the books, but the other half is going out there and in actually doing and practicing and failing at doing it. And some people, usually those really deep in the weeds of Stoicism, will argue that virtue is not a practice. I've always found that conversation rather tedious and pedantic, as you said in the beginning. But you've got to read, you've got to learn, and then you've got to go out there and actually do some work. And I think that a lot of us, me included, probably would benefit with some sort of putting yourself in a position where you might get physically hurt, where you have to physically exert, because it is, for some of us, for me, I don't want to speak for too many people, it is easy to exert brain energy almost at the expense of the physical energy. I do almost no physical work, right? I go to the gym 3 days a week for an hour each week, but it's not, or for an hour each week or each day, but it's not, I'm not doing a lot of work, right? And the idea of doing MMA is terrifying to me, but I can't express why, because to me, I'm not worried about getting hurt. You're doing it with friends in a way. So it's not like somebody's going to kill you while you're in the class, but I have the same feeling about boxing. And I wonder, you make it sound as though you approached martial arts in general at a very young age. You maybe never had this fear. Did you find yourself in life the reverse? Was it difficult for you to approach philosophy? Or do you think having the physical aspect kind of sorted a bit and having it introduce you to doing some thinking, did that make it easy to go in that direction later in your life?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, there's I think that you can get a lot done and you can be very productive with your time if you mix different kinds of things. So for me, my PhD was, 8 hours of studying, 3 hours of training. And that is like a very good rhythm. And it's a very nice rhythm. And they complement each other, right? When you're training, you're getting out of your self-reflective, really high level spot that philosophy brings you into. And then it kind of resets you for the next day of studying. So I think that balance is really helpful. I wasn't uncomfortable with the world of thinking. I think those things are not, they're not analogous. There's something socially scary about doing any sort of craft in public that you're not you don't feel like you're an expert in yet, or you don't feel skilled at. I would feel the same way if I went to improv class as the way anybody would feel going to the first jiu-jitsu class. Like doing anything with a group of people that you're not, there's something socially scary about that I think is good to work on. And then there's once you're expert in kind of domain, there's just analogies, right? Once you're comfortable doing one sport, you say, okay, well, I have a kind of grounding. I feel I can apply this somewhere else. But I think that what is important about sport, and I think this can apply to any craft. I don't think it just has to be martial arts or MMA, but I think it is important to find the most difficult things you can that are the safest or have the least consequences. And I think MMA is very good for that because you go in and you simulate a life or death fight. Jiu-jitsu is the same way. Someone's trying to choke you. You simulate a life or death fight, but you have none of those consequences of somebody actually, you know, harming you, right? It's a consenting activity. And what that allows you to do is it allows you, because we talk about practice and stoicism. What does practice look like? Well, I probably want to find out where I'm weak. Probably want to find out what I need to improve. And how am I going to do that? Probably not going to be by sitting in a chair. It's going to be by going out and encountering situations where my courage is tested, where my self-control is tested, you know, where my capacity for justice or kindness is tested. And what I don't want to do is I don't want to fail at that in situations that have serious consequences. I don't want to, you know, there's a moment where my courage matters and I back down and, you know, I don't stand up to the bully and they continue to pick on somebody. Or there's a moment where my self-control is tested and I fail and I scream at somebody I shouldn't have screamed at or hit somebody I shouldn't have hit. And so now I've tested, but in kind of an unsafe environment. So I, you know, is there a way to simulate that? And for me, sport, especially martial arts, is the best way I've found to find the most difficult thing that has the least real world consequences, pretending to fight, right? And that for me, I think is what it makes it particularly well suited for that stoic training.
Can I ask, just because now I'm curious and maybe other people listening would be curious, maybe they want to give MMA a try. What does your first day look like? Like, are they like, all right, Tanner, you're a big guy, 6'1", 320 pounds. Let's just throw you right in. Is that how it is? Or do you get to practice some things? And is it like karate where, and I know that that's probably an insult to compare karate to what you do, I apologize. But is there like this very basic low level, more like preparing to do things before you actually do things?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to go down the martial arts. Like, I'm happy to dig down the martial arts rabbit hole. So for me—
Let's do it. This is no longer a stoicism podcast.
Yeah, welcome.
Practical martial arts, welcome.
In martial arts, I would say there's two main divisions. There's those that have active resistance and there's those that don't have active resistance. So even there, Tanner, you haven't trained before, right?
Boxing a bit, maybe for like a year, but not seriously.
So even there, though, you made a reference to karate. There's different kinds of karate, which I would say there's some karate that has active resistance and there's some karate that don't have active resistance. And I'd say that's the crucial distinction, because when you get active resistance, that's when you're getting the thing that I talked about, is you're getting feedback both physically, you know, somebody's hitting you or somebody's doing things to you don't want them to do, right? It's a battle of wills. You're sparring. You want to, you know, get on top of them, but now they're on top of you and they're holding you down and you can't get out. There's that kind of battle of wills. There's also an opportunity, really iterative feedback, I would say. So I thought I was good at this technique. I tried to do it. It didn't work. Now I've gotten feedback. Now I need to improve based on the feedback. Those are two things. And then what comes with those things is also this, you know, working hard, exercise, this kind of fit, it being embodied. I think you need those things to get the benefits that I'm talking about. And those martial arts, boxing, as you described, jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, mixed martial arts, wrestling, judo, that's not an exhaustive list, but these sports with active feedback, active resistance against the partner, I think that's most crucial. Unfortunately, that's very uncomfortable, right? So it's like going into a chess club and, you know, you're sitting down and someone's beating you at chess, but if they beat you at chess, they put you in an arm bar or, you know, they get you in a headlock. If they take your knight, it's very uncomfortable. So sometimes what some clubs will do, both in MMA and jiu-jitsu, and is you'll start with drills. And the drills is basically, to keep the chess analogy, this is how the pieces work. This is how the board works. This is how you can move them around, but you're not actually playing a game against somebody else. And so many clubs will start with that. Some might have a beginner program, 3 months, 6 months, just that, no sparring. And the reason for that, I would say, is because, look, it's going to be a lot. It's going to be very intense when you start sparring, even if the person's being nice, it's just going to be intense. It's simulating something that I think is kind of, well, primal, but just, I would say it's really connecting with a part of your nature that pulls out, okay, you know, this fight or flight response. And so you want to have as much context as possible going into that. So clubs will do that. They'll also mix it with a bit of exercise and then a bit of movement. Honestly, there's like some gymnastics components, right? If you've never rolled around on the ground, you haven't done a back roll since you were, you know, 6 years old. It's a weird movement. It's a weird way to move your body. You know, if you never practiced throwing a punch, you never practiced throwing a knee, some of this is just this basic movement skills. So that's it. I would say there's the technique drilling, there's the movement warm up kind of component, and then there's the sparring component. And depending on the club, they might not have the sparring component in the beginner class. They might have it in the beginner class, but I would say hopefully very nice and hopefully with somebody who's meeting you where you're at and kind of plugging into your level of experience.
I'm thinking of, while you were talking about it being gentle and comparing it to chess at the very outset, I got the vision of, do you remember Full Metal Jacket where they're punishing Private Pyle with a bunch of soap and socks? Do you remember that scene?
I remember that. I don't know where you're going with it, but I remember that scene.
Well, I'm imagining someone sticking a bunch of rooks in a sock, and that's what's happening at these really hardcore chess fights to compare it to MMA.
Yeah, exactly. If you lose your piece, that's a whack.
Yeah, you're in big trouble. That's a paddling, as they would say on The Simpsons. Okay, so if somebody wants to get involved in this, are there recommendations for certain, and then I promise everyone we're going to switch to talking about Stoicism, but I find this fascinating, and I imagine a lot of my listeners will as well. Are there outfits or badges or something that you look for to ensure that the school that you join or the club that you join is accredited in some way, that it has a likelihood to be a good place to be, as opposed to, you know, John down the street is teaching MMA in his garage, something like that?
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, I'll stick with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which I know the most about.
Yes, I'm sorry I keep conflating them. I'm understanding it's different. I'm just not used to it.
No. And so MMA is like, that's the broader category, right? Like that's philosophy. And then Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is, you know, ancient Greek philosophy. It's one part of it.
No. You said it. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is Stoicism. There we go. All right, we're there.
There we go. I wish. Then I could just do one thing all the time. The one thing that I would say is that if you're interested in grappling, then I would recommend Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, wrestling, or judo. And so you might have somebody teaching grappling in a club that is not one of those. So you might have, again, a karate school that is teaching grappling. Some of those classes are going to be good. Some of those classes, people are going to know what they're doing. But you generally want to stick to specialization, right? This is all that we do. This is what we know how to do well. And we're not just offering this program because we want more people to come in. And then in terms of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you want to make sure that somebody has a black belt. If you're in a smaller area, has an association with a black belt. There is questions of lineage, but I think that can be hard if you don't know going in. But really, if the person Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts, they're kind of like getting your PhD. Like mine took 10 years of serious training and competition. It's a long time to get one of those. So it represents a serious dedication to the sport and a position where somebody is in a position to teach. It doesn't mean they're a good teacher. And if you don't like the club, I'd recommend going somewhere else. You know, don't force yourself if you're not enjoying it, but the person at least knows their jiu-jitsu. So that's the safest thing at a high level. The other thing I would say is there's like any other craft, the most important thing is that you enjoy it and you keep doing it. So if you look up the most impressive club in your city and you go there and everybody's really intense or it's not the vibe you're looking for, that's not going to be helpful to you that the coach is 20% better there or the students are 20% better if you stop training after 3 months. So like anything else, you know, don't be afraid to shop around a little bit and find a club that fits your personality and fits what you're looking for.
Okay, great. So we're going to take a quick break to hear from some sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to talk about regret and we're going to talk about anger management to whatever degree we can. Stay with us.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
And we're back. Michael, you're laughing at the snaps I do to indicate edits in post-production. But, you know, that's the life, man. You're a podcaster, too. You know, it's a struggle.
They were strong snaps. I was impressed.
Okay. Yeah, my fingers have been to MMA. The Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fingers. Let's talk a little bit about regret, because we talked about it earlier in the week, and also anger. I think there's a strong association in general with things like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, MMA in general, that the people in it are angry. I, of course, know that that's not true. You, of course, know that that's not true, I would think, although I'm sure there are outliers, people who go there because they're angry to deal with anger issues. I'm wondering if you might be able to talk about your own experiences with anger and rage, if you've had them at all, or any anecdotes you could tell that might share a Stoic viewpoint or in some way how you've worked through that or how people you know have worked through that?
Yeah. So the Stoic view of anger is that somebody's harmed you or somebody that you care about, somebody's done a harm and they deserve to be punished, right? That's I would say is the simplest way I could put that. That's from Seneca. And so I view the Stoic, a lot of people look at anger as being reactionary, subconscious, out of your control. Well, you know, he just can't control himself. He's just an angry person. And I don't think anger is like that. I think anger is actually quite intelligent. And the example we used to use in the martial arts club is, you know, say that person can't control their anger. It's like, well, if they can't control their anger, they would lose their anger when they're going to buy groceries. The police would come, they would lose their anger at the police. Then they would be in jail. Then they would lose their temper in jail. And then, you know, that might be the end of them, right? So if you see somebody who actually has a kind of pathological inability to control themselves, we're talking about like a serious pathological issue. Those people are not the 95% of cases when we're talking about people that have anger problems, right? In that case, it's actually a kind of an intelligent response to the situation. It's a perception of the situation. And I would say it is a kind of a disposition towards thinking either I'm vulnerable, so I'm being harmed, bad things are happening to me, or a disposition to think about how do we deal with harm? Because you could have that. You could say, oh, I'm harmed, and you could get kind of depressed. Oh, life is, I'm very sad. So then anger is also this component of, well, if I'm being harmed, somebody deserves punishment. There actually has to be a reaction to that. And so I think there's in anger, there's these two dispositional states. I'm being harmed, and B, somebody needs to be punished for it. There's a consequence, even if that's just the universe, God needs to be punished, you know, like something that I'm just mad at everything. And so when dealing with anger, I think it's about confronting those two things. And I think for me, I actually haven't struggled with anger. We were talking about this before we started. I'm not a very angry person. And I think part of that is the Stoic training, but I think part of that is also this idea that I don't think that people need to be punished. I think I honestly end up becoming more sad or more kind of not offensive. If I get kind of down on myself where I think, woe is me, I think it kind of stays in that sadness part and it doesn't become anger because it doesn't become directed onto other people, which is something I think is just kind of the way that I am. I've always been like that. I've just never really been a very angry person. I would say ironically, you know, without getting into too much personal details, I was wronged by somebody a couple of years ago and I found myself angry and I actually found myself really unable to deal with my anger because I'd never been angry before. And I was like, I don't really know how to get over this because I don't really have the tools in place because it's an unusual emotion for me to feel. And I found myself kind of spiraling in the same kind of thought process and looping over and over and over again.
Okay. So this is interesting because I think most people listening would think that a person who is into mixed martial arts, Brazilian jiu-jitsu in particular, would know exactly how to deal with their anger. So can you talk a little bit about how it's not I want to ask, fighting doesn't seem to do anything to help the thing you were struggling with. And was that surprising to you? Because physical exertion of energy and anger is, I think, what many people think, is a way to deal with stress and anger. And you're saying that for you, it wasn't.
So I think there's kind of two distinctions. I think that's a great point, Tanner. And I think there's kind of two levels of anger here. I think there's one, there's kind of a dispositional high buzz, you know, like somebody, you're walking down the street and somebody bumps into you and you're like, there's that kind of initial reaction that you're just kind of ready to get set off, or, you know, you're driving through traffic and you're flipping somebody off. Absolutely. Sport helps with that. Absolutely. Punching a bag, absolutely grappling helps with that. And maybe that's why I'm like, I've never really been an angry person. Maybe I say that because I've always done martial arts. So I've always had that kind of tuned down. I remember I was really stressed at work a couple months ago, and I was coming back from a long business trip, and I was walking down the street and somebody was like blocking my way. And I had this like impulse. So you talk about stoicism, this impression, then you get to assent to it or not. And I had this impulse to like almost, you know, push my bag into them, almost like, you know, like lash out at them, like get out of my way kind of thing. And I was like, whoa, that's not normal. I don't normally feel that way. That's a weird kind of impression for me to be receiving. And I was like, you know, mindful enough to be like, that's not the kind of thing I want to assent to. It's not the kind of way I want to be. And I think that speaks to how when your stress gets high, when you're not getting ways to exert that stress, maybe sticking to a stoic model here, maybe, you know, you're getting more difficult, you're going to get more difficult impressions to deal with. Your gut reactions are going to be, it's going to require a lot more mindfulness. And so I think this exercise, you know, whether that's fighting or not, but just kind of being in your body, having an outlet, that's a nice way to kind of reset those impressions that you're dealing with and kind of tune those down. And that's kind of different to, but that's a different question to the one of like, you know, maybe I have a family member that did something wrong, you know, when I was younger, and now I have this real anger towards this person. Those are kind of two separate questions. And I don't think that flipping someone off in traffic, and then I've thought about it and I still feel like I've been really wronged. Those are two different kinds of anger. And I think that the fighting helps that one kind. It helps tune down the intensity of those impressions you're receiving. It kind of helps you reset back to a baseline. But it doesn't, I think, answer those more complicated questions, which are really questions of kind of emotional therapy, right? Deeper philosophical questions.
So we're talking about a very physical, fast emotional anger that happens in the moment, and that really time and expression of some sort of energy seems to solve.
That's a great way of putting it.
And then there's this deeper hurt that is like much more of a psychological or mental sort of emotion. Like your example was, maybe you were wronged by someone years ago, or maybe somebody deeply betrayed you. That is an ongoing, much longer lasting thing than a sudden burst of anger or rage. I think that's a very useful distinction. So exercise of any sort, punching a bag, as you said, can help with that first sort. What did you do 2 years ago to deal with this second sort? And how long did it take you to figure it out?
Yeah, I think it took me a long time to figure it out. And I think ironically—
I'm still figuring it out now, and you slam your laptop.
I'm still figuring it out. We're all works in progress here. And I have no interest in claiming to be anything close to a sage. But I think the interesting thing for my journey there was that I think this happens all the time in Stoicism. And I'm interested, Tanner, if you felt the same way, I'm sure people listening have, is when you practice Stoicism for the first time, or even me for a number of years, you end up with this kind of meta stress, this meta anger, this meta regret, which is like, I'm angry at the fact that I'm angry. I'm frustrated at the fact that I'm frustrated, or I'm sad about the fact that I'm sad, because I'm now judging myself. I'm now saying, well, a Stoic wouldn't do this. And so I think when I experienced that, you know, let's say talk about it as a betrayal, I think it's a good way of putting it. When I experienced that, I tried to numb, which is to say I would try to have not leaned into the feeling, because it's well, it doesn't make sense. It's not a real harm. It's not, you know, it's an indifferent. It's what somebody else, you know, it's somebody else's behavior that's outside of my control. I acted well in that situation, that their behavior is not up to me, and so on and so forth. And I feel like I expected the other side of anger to be equanimity, or to be nothingness. And I think what I learned there is like, well, you're going to have kind of strong feelings about the situation or strong feelings about this person. And the other side of that doesn't have to be nothing, but we just don't want the other side of that to be a kind of a passion, right? A kind of really something that's not serving me, and it's not true, and it's not helping me in any sort of way. It's kind of like this maladaptive emotional response based on me not looking at things the right way. So I mean, that's kind of vague because it's personal, but trying to say that the way that I got through it was by letting myself stop trying to numb it or block it or meta judge it, and really actually lean into it so I could get to the other side of it and still be left with a strong feeling, but not a strong feeling in a way that I would say is kind of like a toxic feeling. And so to come to terms with it in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's funny that I'm going through something very similar right now. I wonder if, did your thing ever have like a public component to it where you felt a need to defend yourself in any way, but ultimately realized that would just make it worse?
Yeah, I feel like there's some aspect of it. There's an aspect of wanting to control a story, right?
Oh man, totally. Yes. Yeah.
Wanting to, and again, that's the, like, well, it matters what other people think, because not only is this untrue, but it's untrue in a kind of a very distorted way. Yeah. And that's, so yeah, absolutely, it was a part of it.
Crazy. Well, it seems like all of us wind up going through, isn't it interesting that we can all wind up going through the same sorts of things at different phases in our lives? I just feel like the human condition is the same for everyone. We try to pretend like everybody's experience is different, but I think it's just differently timed. That's how I feel about everybody's life. They all go through the same stuff. That's probably wrong, but that's how I feel about it. What about regret? Because certainly mixed up, I think, in anger and rage. At least this is definitely the case for me presently and has been the case in the past and will probably be the case again in the future. When you get mad or feel hurt or feel betrayed or whatever it is, there's regret has to be tied up in that because it feels like something was lost, whether it was an opportunity or a friendship or a life for that matter, that can also be lost, of course. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think regret is one of those interesting ones because the Stoics say, look, we shouldn't feel passions. We shouldn't feel extreme emotions about things that are outside of our control. We should feel things about indifference. We should care about them, but not extreme things. But we should actually feel intensely. I mean, what Epictetus would say is we should ascribe the labels of good and bad to the things that are inside our control instead of just, I prefer this or I don't prefer this. No, virtue is actually good. Vice is actually bad. And so then there's this interesting thing with regret. And there's kind of two ways you can take regret, right? Regret is like, I think there's regret that's kind of like grief. Or sadness, like I really wish that didn't happen. And then there's regret, like I'm ashamed of what I did. I feel guilty. And I guess I just want to maybe pull those apart. And so I think the I wish things would have gone differently. I mean, that's a very common feeling. That is kind of amor fati, right? That is embracing fate, embracing life as it happened, trying to come to terms with how things were. That's a very common Stoic exercise. I think it's simple, but I don't think it's easy. But I think the answer is simple, which is to say, you know, you obviously have no control over the past. You have to try to come to terms with it. You have to try to figure out the silver lining, figure out the way to the lesson there, the way that obstacle could be turned to your benefit and how that will change your behavior moving forward. Seneca and Marcus Aurelius talk about circumscribing the present, right? Like if we can keep our focus in the now, that's one of the most important ways to be happy. Not allowing it to drift into the past and not allowing it to become anxiety. So regret in the past, anxiety in the future. But then there's this question of, well, what if you were the jerk, right? What if you have regret and shame because you did the bad thing? Because isn't Epictetus, aren't the Stoics telling us that that was a bad thing? You acted viciously. And I think that's a complicated question and a difficult question. But what I try to do is the same kind of thing, which is the circumscribing of the present. So you're correct that a bad thing happened then and that person was you, but that person is not you now. And then again, same thing. Well, what do I do now in relation to that? So you acknowledge that. You don't ignore it, but you also, again, reframe the focus to the present. Was that, which type of regret were you focusing on? Because I made that distinction between the two.
Well, earlier, last Friday, I think at this point, I did actually talk about both. I talked about an example where a friend died and you feel regret because of things that didn't happen for him, perhaps, or things that didn't happen. You had an argument with him by accident or weren't there for his birthday versus something like you decided to drive drunk and killed him in a car wreck as a result. And that those were two very different kinds of regret. And what's funny is we wound up at the same place. We wound up thinking the exact same thing. And in the first case, it's simpler said than done, but the answer is obvious. This is past amor fati, although I didn't say amor fati in the episode, same thing. But for the latter sort, the more serious sort, I would say, one that almost seems reasonable and logical for you to feel, that the answer is to realize that, hey, while everyone else might think you're a murderer for this, and there might be plenty of us outside judgment, and you do feel bad and you should feel bad because you did do something wrong, the answer to move forward from it is to say, that is who I was. And this is a nexus at which it doesn't have to be who I am anymore. I can choose right now. I can use this to choose to be different. And I think it seems like we're very in alignment there.
Yeah, I would say that's the exact same argument because I think that Stoicism often has these two levels. One level is this kind of therapeutic, well, I don't want to be sad. What can Stoicism tell me not to be sad? And it's like, well, what do you do in situations where you should be sad, right? that's the question, right? It's not always about, okay, what's the Stoic trick for me not to feel bad because I drunk drove and killed somebody?
Right.
Well, maybe the Stoic answer is you should feel bad there, right? But it's always proportional and it's always accurate. So any sort of story, I'm a monster, any sort of story, I don't deserve to live, my life is meaningless now, that's the emotions that come from that, those are passions because they're not grounded in reality. Those things are not true. Then other sorts of stories, well, it doesn't matter. You know, it wasn't my fault. I didn't have any, like, I couldn't have controlled myself there. Those are also not true. So it's about coming to see the world as it is. And that's more difficult and messy, complicated situations like this, where there is a bit of regret, there should be a bit of sadness because there is a bad thing that happened, but it's also proportional and it recognizes your capacity to make amends. It recognizes your capacity to act differently moving forward. And it recognizes these realities as well. And that's the thing that I come back to in these messy situations. The Stoic idea is always to live in accordance with nature, which means to see things as they really are, to see the truth of the matter, and to not get caught up in either of these stories, the ones that numb the pain or the ones that overindulge in it. And again, much easier said than done. We're all practicing that. We're all working on it. But we see this and we admire those people, right? The people who maybe killed somebody and spend their life working on stopping gang violence, right? We don't look at those people, just in common sense, we don't look at those people and judge them. We say, wow, that's amazing. And there is a sense in which that bad has been combated with a good. But there's also a responsibility there, right? That person has done something. That person has made a change. And I think that responsibility is something we all have and something the Stoics would say comes with our capacity to change, right? Because we can change, we have that responsibility to do so.
I also think it might be worth noting that in instances where we do view those people as being very amazing, I think that Dave's Bread has a story like this, where I think the guy who makes this bread that is, you know, it's like a $7 loaf of multi-seeded bread or something at this point, that I think he went to prison for murder or some very serious crime. And now he's doing a lot of good things in the community in the way that you've just said. And he's got this bread company that donates things to something. I'm not completely clear on the story. I should have probably done research, but it just popped in my head. I think it's important to note that while we recognize people like that, when they've gotten to that point, that person, and that person might be you, not you, Michael, but the you listening, that might be you. There are no doubt decades of Dave's life where he was just ignoring everything that was being said about him and he was focused on trying to make amends. And it's nice to think that maybe one day we'll be vindicated in some way, but it's probably more important, not probably, definitely is more important to be during that transition to get to that time if it ever shows up, that we are heads down focused on making amends if that's what we need to do and doing the work of getting through the regret or whatever it is that we're getting through, that we're focused on that and not on what people think of how we're doing it or what people will think of us one day.
Yeah, I appreciate that framing. I think that's helpful. One thing I was trying to say there was that we can get caught up in stories, right? Like I've done this, so there's no answer. And so what the Dave's Bread example is like, you're not making amends because you want to be Dave's Bread, because you want people to shout you out on podcasts and you have a successful company, but it's proof. It's just evidence that things are not hopeless, both morally and in terms of the way you think about yourself is not the way you would think about somebody else in the same situation, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune into Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, don't believe everything you read.
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, so this has been a good conversation. I think we've maybe got 10 or 15 minutes left. We've talked about MMA. We've talked about Brazilian jiu-jitsu. We've talked about bad experiences, getting through rage, getting through feelings of regret. And I mean, what's next on this grab bag of an episode, Michael? What should we talk about next?
I'm always happy to talk about Epictetus. Is there any sort of Epictetus?
Yeah, sure. We can talk about Epictetus. Let's start with Enchiridion 1. No, I'm just kidding. Well, so I recently discovered that Epictetus's name meant owned or possessed or bought or something, and that was very interesting to me. What are some unique things about Epictetus, whether from one of his publications or publications is a strong word, from one of his works or from a story of his life that is lesser known? Because really all I know about Epictetus is that he was from Turkey when it was technically Greece, and or maybe that's not exactly right, and that he wrote the Enchiridion. He didn't write the Enchiridion. I guess his student wrote the Enchiridion, but had discourses, taught people, Roman guy. We all know him and we all love him. But I don't know any cool details about him. There's a lot of stuff missing there. Do you have any cool details about Epictetus you would have discovered in doing your, I think you said your PhD thesis on him, correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, historically, I obviously wish there was more, right? In terms of his background, he was a slave in Rome, right? After he was born in modern day Persia, as you mentioned. Something that I think is interesting to think about this too is the way in which slavery is quite different from American slavery. So my understanding of Roman slavery, and again, my background's in philosophy, not classics. So learning all of this through my study of Epictetus, but there was opportunities for slaves to take up quite important positions in households, opportunities for slaves to become educated. And Epictetus was in a fairly important household. So his master, his owner, was, however you like to phrase it, was actually in the court of Nero, as I understand it. So there is that connection once again, you know, through Seneca as well. You know, maybe they wouldn't have been in the exact same circles with each other, but there's this connection once again to emperors of Rome through Epictetus's owner, and then Epictetus is a slave in that household. And then obviously the story is that he was given the opportunity to study philosophy. He learned it from Musonius Rufus in Rome and then opened up his school. One thing an interesting framing about this school, I think, in his time is that there is, he's teaching basically young men, well-to-do young men who are maybe, you know, 18 to 15, preparing for a life in politics, preparing for a life in industry. And one thing that I was learning about was that there was this interesting reception of philosophy as well, where it was seen as something that was good to have, but something that is not good to dedicate your life to. Something that was seen as, you know, you wanted to have your philosophical education, but you didn't want to become a philosopher. That was embarrassing.
You want to be smart, but you don't want to be a stinky old Diogenes or a weird old Epictetus. Yeah,
yeah, right. Exactly. So there's this dynamic in his teachings and his discourses. And you can think about that as a liberal arts education, right? There's still this tradition, at least in the United States, of very wealthy people sending their kids not to do finance, but to go to these small liberal arts schools, but then they're expected to then leave them and go do finance or go do work in the business world. And if they stayed there, then there's this kind of break. So there's this context where Epictetus actually has a very limited time with these people, and they're kind of potentially not as receptive as you might imagine them to be. And so there is this responsibility to get them turned into philosophers for the rest of their life, I would say, kind of shock them into pursuit for the rest of their life, because otherwise they're at risk of being that student that Epictetus makes fun of, the one who can recite all the lines of Chrysippus, but not actually act it out. And I remember, I think of this of like Boris Johnson, you know, this was able to recite these lines of, it was either the Odyssey or the Iliad, and that was this example of this private British education model, right? Where there's this education in the classics, there's this education in Greek, and Boris Johnson can say these lines of Homer from memory. But there's obviously this, or there's potentially this break here. I don't know enough about Boris Johnson to say more, but there's, just because you can recite Homer doesn't mean necessarily you've internalized these lessons. And so Epictetus, I think, is dealing with this, with these students in this kind of context, the ones who can leave and go to Roman court and be, you know, yeah, I can recite Chrysippus. I have my education and logic, but they go around doing terrible things. And so he's trying to shock them out of this in the moment that he has. And I thought that was kind of an interesting recontextualization of the discourses. These are students, but not necessarily students who are coming because they love philosophy, and not necessarily students who plan on doing this afterwards. So there's this moment in time you have to kind of put them on the path and pull them off the path of, you know, being what people in that area are more likely to be, which is concerned with wealth, concerned with your appearance and your reputation.
I really love this because it gives me the idea that now I understand why he was so grumpy. He thinks he's going to open up like the Juilliard of philosophy and get all these people who want to be philosophers. And instead, he accidentally opens like the Harvard Business School and he's having to teach a bunch of people a lot in 5 seconds. And he's pissed off about it because it's never the school he wanted. That's
well, exactly. He's like, you've got to learn this. And they're like, I can repeat it back to you. And he's like, no. Yeah, that's not learning.
What's going to be on the test, Epictetus? Come on.
Yeah, exactly. I need to have a good report card for my parents, so they'll keep paying for it. This kind of situation. And I think that's an interesting context. I think you're dead on. I never put that connection, but that is where there's the grumpiness, right? There is this, I've got a responsibility to kind of shock you out of your complacency. I've got a responsibility to make a difference here with the time I have.
I can't remember what the name of the movie is, but the teacher walks in and the kids are, you know, it's like an inner city high school and they get them really excited about Shakespeare. And I want to say that it's Danny DeVito. Is it?
I know the one you're talking about. I think I know the one you're talking about. I don't remember Danny DeVito. I'm thinking like a Hillary Swank or something, but same kind of thing.
So I'm saying Danny DeVito, I guess. Why not?
We'll stick with Danny DeVito.
Yeah. Who is the Danny DeVito version in the Stoic philosophical tradition? Is there an antithesis to Epictetus's grumpiness? Is there somebody who's the opposite of him?
Somebody who's more outgoing. I mean, not Musonius Rufus. So right. maybe not. There's this excellent line about Musonius Rufus. So we've been talking about sport and I was doing some research into Musonius Rufus's treatment of sport. Like, do the Stoics think exercise is actually helpful to develop character? I can talk about it. I can make these analogies, but do they actually think it's helpful? We know the Stoics don't think you should be brutal on your body. Like, they don't think, you know, the kind of the ice bath, the restricting your food, going through pain. They're not a fan of this. They don't think it's necessary. But one thing that Musonius Rufus talks about is he's in Rome and he's talking to, this is examples of talking to Spartans and being like, wow, there's actually something to this because these teenagers are not like the other teenagers. And he's saying, he's teaching this lecture and he's saying, you know, pain is or pleasure is an indifferent. That might be very surprising to you. Pain is an indifferent. And the Spartans go, but Musonius, isn't pain a good? Like, isn't that a good thing because of all their athletics training and all their brutal training? And Musonius goes, well, look, it's not a good, but I'd much rather have a student who comes to me thinking that. That's one that's much easier to train than a student who's had all the pleasures and luxuries their whole life. And you have to untrain this thinking that pleasure is a good.
And that is the moment that Musonius decided to dupe Epictetus into taking on the project of the Harvard Business School Philosophy School. And he would go
Yeah, he'll keep those guys. Yeah.
All right, Michael. Well, hey, man, this has been fun. Thank you for going with me on this very strange journey where we had nothing planned. I appreciate it. You showed up with almost no notice, and I'm grateful to you for that. Is there anything that you want to promote or make people aware of in these last couple of minutes?
Yeah, I mean, so I've got the Stoic Conversations podcast. If you thought, you know, hey, this guy sounds reasonably interesting, I want to hear a little bit more of that. There's an episode with yourself, Tanner, if you want that as a starting place. We co-host Caleb and I, we talk philosophy. We talk Stoicism and we talk to a variety of guests, you know, academics, authors, experts about really this question of philosophy as a way of life. That's really what interests us. We also, as you know, Tanner, have our app Stoic Meditations. And the goal for that app is to provide a platform where people can put Stoicism into practice. So you've got the theory, you want the practice. This is a place where you, through mindful meditations, through lessons, you develop a routine of really active reflection, active thinking, a kind of a journaling process, or really a reflection on your day, or a active reflection on these concepts. So you maybe you've heard about the dichotomy of control, maybe you've heard about the Stoic theory of the passions, but let's actually do some guided meditations to reflect on those, see how they apply to your life. And that's a project that I'm just very passionate about, because trying to figure out effective ways to help people put Stoicism into their life a little bit at a time, very similar to what you're doing, Tanner. And I appreciate the opportunity to come on and chat with you. It's always a lot of fun to chat.
Of course, man. So where can they find the podcast? Is it just Stoic Meditations or Stoic Conversations, I should say, .com?
Yeah, so it's Stoic Conversations. You can find that iTunes, Spotify, anywhere you find your podcasts. And then Stoic Meditations, that is on the Google Play Store. That's on the Apple App Store. So anywhere you get your either your phone apps.
wherever that is.
Wherever that is, like that. I have my iPhone. That's what I use.
Okay, cool, Michael. Thank you for being here. I'll let you go. And everyone, until next time, consider becoming a patron of this podcast by going to stoicismpod.com/members. And until next time, take care.